You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire. A supply chain attack targets Python developers. Russia targets German political parties. Romanian and Spanish police dismantle a cyber fraud gang. Pwn to own prompts quick patches from Mozilla. President Biden nominates the first Assistant Secretary of Defense for Cyber Policy at the Pentagon. An influential think tank calls for a dedicated cyber service in the U.S. Unit 42 tracks a Strela Stira surge. GM reverses its data sharing practice. Our guest is Anna Bellick, Director of the Office of Cybersecurity Strategy at SysDig, who shares trends in cloud-native security. And a Fordham Law School professor suggests AI creators take a page from medical doctors. It's Monday, March 25th, 2024. I'm Dave Bittner, and this is your CyberWire Intel Briefing. Happy Monday, everyone. It is great to have you here with us today. Hackers targeted Python developers by creating a malicious clone of the popular Colorama tool, which aids in using ANSI escape character sequences on Windows. They executed a supply chain attack by typo-squatting a legitimate Python mirror domain to distribute the clone. Among the victims was a maintainer of top.gg, a platform with a large Discord community. The attackers hijacked accounts, including editor syntax, to spread the malware through compromised commits and increase the visibility of malicious repositories. The attack method involved using stolen cookies for account access, blending malicious files with legitimate ones, and hiding malicious code within the Colorama clone. Once executed, the malware stole data from browsers, Discord, cryptocurrency wallets, and more, transmitting it via various methods. Given the growing prevalence of supply chain attacks, our "Don't Come to Me with Problems Without Also Bringing Me Solutions" desk came up with five tactics that you and your team can employ to fortify your supply chain defenses and ensure your code remains secure. First up, meticulously verify package sources. The crux of many attacks lies in the deceptive simplicity of typo squatting, where fraudulent URLs mimic those of legitimate sources. By double-checking the authenticity of package sources and being vigilant against misleading URLs, developers can thwart attempts to introduce malicious clones into their projects. Next, let's talk about package signing and verification. This robust mechanism serves as a gatekeeper, confirming both the integrity and the origin of your packages. By embracing this practice, you're building a formidable barrier, ensuring that only verified packages make their way into your supply chain. Implementing multi-factor authentication across all developer accounts and environments is our third tactic. In an era where account credentials can be compromised, adding an additional layer of security through MFA is invaluable. This simple yet effective measure can significantly decrease the likelihood of unauthorized access, safeguarding your repositories against compromised accounts. The fourth tactic involves employing automated security scanning tools. These proactively scan for unusual patterns within your codebase and dependencies. By identifying potential risks before they're woven into your project, these tools act as an early warning system. Lastly, implement rigorous code review processes. Peer reviews are more than just quality checks. They're a collective effort to spot and rectify anomalies that might escape automated detection. This human-centric approach leverages the expertise of your development team, applying a critical eye to every change and ensuring that your code base remains resilient against vulnerabilities. By integrating these five tactics into your development practices, you're contributing to a more secure ecosystem for the entire community. Mandiant reports that APT29, a hacking group tied to Russia's SVR, has shifted focus to target German political parties, specifically using phishing campaigns themed around the Christian Democratic Union. This marks a departure from their usual targets like governments and diplomatic missions. The phishing attacks deploy a backdoor malware named WineLoader, granting remote access to compromised devices. This malware, first spotted in operations against various countries' diplomats, is noted for its encrypted communication with its control server and modular, customized design for espionage. Mandiant's discovery of APT29's campaign against German political entities highlights the group's evolving tactics and continued efforts to infiltrate and gather intelligence, possibly aiming to influence or monitor political processes. Romanian and Spanish police dismantled a cyber fraud gang, seizing over €182,000 in cash, gold, and numerous electronic devices after conducting 22 house searches in Romania. The gang, involved in sophisticated scams including fake ads and business email compromise, tricked victims, primarily in Spain, into paying for non-existent holiday rentals, cars, and electronics. Losses ranged from €200 to €10,000 per victim. Organized into three units for operations, phishing, and money laundering, the gang's activities highlight the growing threat and complexity of cyber fraud, with BEC scams alone generating over $2.9 billion in 2023. Europol described the group's operations as unprecedented in sophistication, necessitating a comprehensive investigation to dismantle. Mozilla swiftly patched two critical zero-day vulnerabilities in Firefox that were identified by Manfred Paul at the Pwn2Own Vancouver 2024 event. These flaws allowed attackers to escape the browser's sandbox and execute code on the system. One of the bugs involves out-of-bounds access that can bypass range analysis, while another permits privileged JavaScript execution, leading to a sandbox escape, but is only exploitable in desktop versions of Firefox. Manfred Paul earned $100,000 for these Firefox vulnerabilities as part of the Pwn2Own contest that saw participants earning over $1.1 million. President Joe Biden has nominated Michael Sulmeier as the inaugural Assistant Secretary of Defense for Cyber Policy at the Pentagon, a position mandated by the 2023 Defense Policy Bill to enhance focus on civilian-led cyber policy. Sulmeier, currently a principal cyber advisor to the Secretary of the Army, brings extensive experience from roles in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Council, Cyber Command, and academia. His background includes directing the cybersecurity project at Harvard's Belfer Center and affiliations with University of Texas School of Law and Georgetown Center for Security and Emerging Technology. Congratulations to Mr. Sulmeier and best wishes for success. The Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a nonpartisan Washington think tank, advocates for the U.S. to establish a dedicated cyber service to address recruitment challenges, coordination issues and the lack of a cohesive culture for digital warriors. Highlighting cyberspace as a critical warfighting domain, the think tank emphasizes the urgency for Congress to act to ensure sustainable cyber force readiness. With the military struggling to develop a talent pipeline and provide sufficient support, the report suggests starting a cyber force with around 10,000 personnel and a $16.5 billion budget under the Army's auspices. The recommendation comes amid growing concerns over cyber threats from rivals like Russia and China, and debates over enhancing the Department of Defense's cyber capabilities, including the discussed Cyber Command 2.0 initiative. The think tank plans to lobby lawmakers for an independent study into establishing this new military branch, aiming to enhance the U.S.'s cyber posture amidst evolving global cyber challenges. Palo Alto Networks Unit 42 has uncovered a surge in Strela Stealer malware attacks, impacting over 100 organizations across the EU and U.S. Initiated through spam emails with malicious attachments, the latest variant of Strela Stealer, an email credential stealer first identified in November of 2022, employs updated obfuscation techniques and is delivered via a zipped JScript file. The campaigns, notably aggressive in November 2023 and peaking again on January 29th of 2024, have targeted sectors such as high-tech, finance, legal, and manufacturing. The malware's distribution method involves spear phishing emails that lead to the download of a JScript file, which then drops and executes a Base64 encrypted DLL payload using sophisticated evasion tactics. This development demonstrates the malware's continuous evolution and the threat actor's efforts to bypass security measures. General Motors has ceased sharing driver data with LexisNexis Risk Solutions and Verisk, data brokers for the insurance industry, after a New York Times report revealed GM's practice of sharing detailed driving behavior through its OnStar Smart Driver feature. The feature, available in GM's internet-connected cars, tracked and shared information on mileage, braking, acceleration, and speed, affecting some drivers' insurance rates. The decision comes as a Florida man files a class action complaint against GM and involved parties, following a significant increase in his insurance rates linked to the collection of driving data. Over 8 million vehicles were part of the Smart Driver program, which generated revenue in the low millions for GM annually. A tip of the hat to New York Times technology reporter Kashmir Hill for running down this story, and in doing so demonstrating why good journalism helps keep big companies like GM honest. Coming up after the break, my conversation with Anna Bellick, Director of the Office of Cybersecurity Strategy at SysDig. We're talking cloud-native security. Stay with us. Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business. I recently had the pleasure of speaking with Anna Bellick, Director of the Office of Cybersecurity Strategy at Sysdig. She shared trends in cloud-native security.
So we started this report, I want to say, I'm going to get it wrong, in like 2018. Anyway, whatever 7 years ago is. Mm-hmm. And the beauty of it is that unlike a lot of reports that you see, which are survey data where people express how they feel about their environment, this is actual data of what people are actually doing in their environment because our tool provides visibility into that and we're able to aggregate and anonymously share what all actual customers are doing in the cloud.
Well, let's dig into some of the details here. What are some of the things that caught your eye?
You know, every year I see the data and I'm like, I'm surprised, I'm not surprised. I can't really decide if it's actually surprising. So maybe for me, the unsurprising one that's nonetheless a bit startling is the identity data. So we found last year a very high percent of permissions that are granted to cloud accounts are unused. And this year, we actually saw that number go up. So this year, it's 98% of permissions that are granted are not used.
Hmm. Unpack that for me. What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, so this is basically your like default password problem from the old days, right? So what happens in the cloud is we have all these different roles and identities we create. And it's actually quite complex, right? Because you need different types of identities to do different things. So you have humans who are, you know, administering things. You have machine identities that perform certain tasks only. And then you may have like interesting roles designed in specific ways for specific environments or purposes, right? And so you would think, because you have all this flexibility, you could design a very explicit set of permissions. So any given human or machine can only access the required assets or the required, you know, tasks that they can perform and so on. But what actually happens in real life is nobody has the time to do that. And also, it's not clear whose explicit responsibility it is to define those policies. So people just do the thing that's the fastest and most convenient, which is grant most accounts like all possible privileges they would ever need and then not revoke them. So what you end up with is a whole lot of identities in the cloud that have way too much access that they really don't need. And that creates a lot of opportunity for attackers.
Yeah, that's interesting. What other things caught your attention here?
So my favorite data point is actually a little bit complex, so I'm just going to touch on it, but it's about drift control, right? So drift control is this notion that if you are in the cloud and you define everything as code, then you always know if the environment or the workload or the configuration has changed from what it was supposed to be, because it's like literally codified in policy. And we have a capability in our tool that lets you see when those workloads have changed. So we saw that 25% of our customers have it turned on, and 4% of our customers have it turned on in blocking mode. So that means they do not allow drift on workloads.
Hmm.
And at first I was like, well, those numbers are kind of small. But actually, blocking mode is pretty intense, right? So this means that you are so certain that your workloads are truly immutable that any drift in them is unacceptable to the point where you don't even want to see an alert. You're just going to kill it, right? And I think that's pretty, like, that's very forward-looking. That means that people are actually, have learned how to design architectures that are truly cloud-native and how to build security around those architectures in a way that actually ends up saving a lot of the noise, right? Because we hear about noise a lot, and blocking drift is like, well, there's no noise because it's just gone, right? So I thought that was pretty cool in terms of, like, optimism.
That is cool. What about the 25% who have it on but aren't, you're being so intense about it?
Yeah, so I think that speaks to the fact that most orgs are, like, you know, in real life transitioning from some legacy state to some future state, and they may, you know, forever operate a hybrid environment because there are lots of applications that have business value that are just not worth refactoring, right? So I suspect that in the 25%, what's going on is they're either applying the drift policy, like they're turning it up, like they started with alerting so they can see what's going on, and they're maybe changing their workloads to be drift blockable, even though they're not prepared yet. Or they maybe have just like multiple types of workloads, like they have some workloads that are immutable and some that are mutable, and maybe they're commingled somehow. So in any case, like most environments are kind of a mess. And so I suspect that most of the folks who have it on in a learning mode are in some sort of transition state where they are maturing the organization, essentially, which is also encouraging, by the way.
Was there anything particularly surprising or unexpected for you?
I would say, you mean about Drift or about in general?
Just in general.
I would say the AI data point. Now, people know that I'm a filthy AI skeptic. I just...
But you own it.
I mean, you got to lean in, right?
Right.
There's two reasons I'm an AI skeptic. One is that I have a PhD in computational physics, so I know what it looks like underneath. And the other is that when I was at Gartner, the machine learning craze came through about, almost 10 years ago now, where everything was ML, 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 and like 99% of that was just BS, right? So now we're doing the same thing, except it's AI, 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 because now it's a different flavor of AI, and it's like 99% BS. the data point we found, we basically looked at who has deployed the packages, the AI packages in their environment, right? So you have to understand that most people interact with AI these days through an API. So they're using like ChatGPT, they're typing stuff into a box, which means it's someone else's environment that's actually performing the calculation and you're just giving it some parameters, right? But if you believe the hype that like AI is the future and like nobody can survive in business without adopting AI, you would expect a lot more organizations to be building their own stuff. And I don't mean like making their own models necessarily, but I mean like building applications around models or leveraging these packages. So like deploying that capability inside their own infrastructure as opposed to just making an API call, right? And what we actually did see was this number was very small. So we only saw 31% of users integrate any kind of AI. And most of that AI was not gen AI. It was like statistical models, machine learning models, like analytics of various kinds. So of the 31% that we saw deploying anything, only 15% were gen AI, right? So that indicates a much lower adoption than what you would expect from what you hear in the media and like see kind of on the internet.
So is that, I will be cynical and say, is that, you know, checkbox AI for the marketing department?
You know, it's...
Or so am I overstating
theory,
it?
my like security optimist theory is that people are actually cautious because of the security and safety implications of AI.
Okay.
My true cynic theory is that, honestly, there are not that many phenomenal use cases for this in all lines of business, right? And that's sort of my perspective in general on the current wave of AI is like there's some phenomenal use cases for large language models and for generative AI in general. My favorite is maybe like art. Like there's really cool digital manipulation you could now do with AI that's like amazing. But for every company in the world to have to use Gen AI for whatever it is they're doing is kind of silly because there are very few technologies that actually unilaterally affect everybody. So my theory is just that the folks who really are going to benefit from this are going all in and the rest of us are kind of like making noises but not really going all in.
Hmm. So based on the information that you all have gathered here, what are your recommendations? What are the actionable bits of advice you can share?
I think the biggest take home is a little disappointing, I guess, and it's just that we're still doing the same things we've always been doing, right? Like we're still choosing convenience and speed over like security and rigor and quality. And it's very understandable why that is, right? Like it's very clear that A, we're all humans and we just want to get the job done. And B, like ultimately your business exists because it makes money. And so anything that impedes the making of money is kind of bad. So I think we still have a lot of work to do on the security side of kind of proving to the business that security is a value add and not a money sink. And then also, you know, on a technical side, creating a lot more simple processes for the various teams who are not themselves security teams to perform their work more securely, kind of inherently, right? So I think that's kind of the challenge of the next decade. I mean, it's not easy. We've been trying to do it for a long time. And now we're just trying to do it in a whole new environment of cloud, which has its own, you know, complexities and then new problems and so on. So I think that's the sad one. The kind of happier one is sort of what I pointed out about like, you know, Drift and even AI, right? That you see these small numbers like, 15% of 30% or like 4% blocking, whatever. And that feels like not very much. But I think you got to take a different perspective and say like, listen, those guys are early adopters and they're really pushing the frontiers and they are clearly successful, right? So I just think that's more of a signal that we have a lot of opportunity to become more secure in this novel environment, and we should sort of pattern our efforts after those folks that have in fact already done it.
That's Anna Bellick, Director of the Office of Cybersecurity Strategy at SysDig.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
And finally, an academic paper from Shinmayi Sharma, associate professor of law at Fordham Law School, makes the case that the core issue with AI's potential for harm, ranging from bias to manipulation, is not the technology itself, but its creators, who are often guided by profit-driven companies rather than the pursuit of safe, socially beneficial products. Sharma says government and litigation have been ineffective in curbing detrimental AI engineering practices. The proposed solution is to professionalize AI engineering, requiring engineers to obtain licenses for building commercial AI products, adhere to scientifically backed technical standards, and self-regulate. This approach aims to prevent AI harms by influencing engineering decisions at their source, shifting control from companies to engineers, and fostering the development of trustworthy AI by design. This move towards professionalization is likened to practices in other fields where public welfare is paramount, suggesting that AI engineers should also prioritize doing no harm, similar to medical professionals. It's an interesting proposal, worth a read. I can imagine a Hippocratic oath for AI. At the top of the list, of course, would be, first, do no harm. Maybe number two should be, do not create Skynet. And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. We'd love to know what you think of this podcast. You can email us at cyberwire@n2k.com. N2K Strategic Workforce Intelligence optimizes the value of your biggest investment, your people. We make you smarter about your team while making your team smarter. Learn more at n2k.com. This episode was produced by Liz Stokes. Our mixer is Trey Hester, with original music by Elliot Peltzman. Our executive producers are Jennifer Iben and Brandon Karp. Our executive editor is Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.